Okay, welcome back. We're going to continue our look at trauma-induced mind control. Not mass mind control. We've done a lot of that. We're talking about individuals, small groups, and maybe even larger groups than that. Talking about cults and other, quote, organizations which subdue, subvert, and subject the human mind and psyche to horrors, among other things. My guest this hour, a very special guest, is Dr. Colin Ross. He is an internationally renowned clinician, researcher, author, and lecturer in the field of dissociation and trauma-related disorders. He is the founder and president of the Colin A. Ross Institute for Psychological Trauma. And hopefully you'll visit his website. It's quite extraordinary. The Colin Ross Institute was formed in 1995 to further the understanding of the psychological trauma and its consequences by providing educational services, research, and clinical treatment of trauma-based disorders. It's quite an amazing resource for people. I saw recently, and I ran it at my website, the Conspiracy Theory television program with Jesse Ventura on mind control. And it featured Dr. Colin Ross in a pivotal part in that half-hour program. And I got in touch with him, and he was kind enough to come on, even on Valentine's Day. Thank you, Dr. Ross, very much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. This is a big problem, and getting bigger all the time. We could take it in the macro or the micro, but I want to stay with the micro this time and talk about individuals who have, for one reason or another, been co-opted in ways that they'll never understand to do things that, in normal circumstances, they probably never would do. This was made clear in the Ventura program and certainly many, many others. You are considered to be as good as there is on this planet in understanding it and trying to help people break free of it. How widespread is it in this society of ours, Colin?
Well, maybe we should just define what it is that we're talking about a little bit.
Please do.
You may have something a little bit different in mind from what I have, but let me just explain how I got into all this. So I'm a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
And I really wasn't aware of multiple personality disorder very much until I ran into a case as a medical student, actually. And then I started researching it and got interested in it. And then I thought, well, boy, that's really interesting, but it's so rare, I'll probably never see another case. And then I saw another case, and then another, and then I started getting referrals, and that's how I got into the whole subject of multiple personality disorder, which is now called dissociative identity disorder.
DID.
And DID, yeah. And so then I was relatively expert in DID, and I wrote a textbook about it and stuff. And then I moved from Canada to Dallas late 91. And at that point in time, no real interest in mind control, CIA, and that kind of stuff. And then patients started telling me, not that they were abused by their dad or their uncle or their brother, but they were taken to either a military base, some sort of hospital setting, and experiments were done on them. It includes a whole variety of different techniques for the purpose of creating programmed alter personality. And they described this in a fair bit of detail. And it was not just one person, it was a series of people. And so then I thought, well, that's pretty weird. I'm going to look into it. And looking into it meant reading the small number of books on the subject and then going down to a CIA reading room, which was in Arlington, Virginia.
Uh-huh.
Looking at some MKUltra documents, and then in the end, ordering all of them, which is about 15,000 pages of Bluebird, Artichoke, MKUltra, other mind control programs that ran from 1950, basically, till the early 70s, which were all declassified in the 70s. And then from there, going to the medical school library and sifting through by hand journals from 1950 into the early 70s, basically, collecting up dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of papers by psychiatrists, where it would say at the bottom, funded by Air Force, Navy, not the CIA, but the branches of the military.
Well, they always keep their hands clean, or they try to.
Right. And then...
How did you feel about...
The whole Manchurian candidate investigation.
Yeah. All right. Colin, how did you feel about it when you saw that the military was not, in a minor sense, interested in mind control, but they had a big interest in DID, MPD, the creating of multiple personalities in people for various reasons, many obviously very ugly. That must have been a little bit of a disconcerting realization that this is buried into the depths of the military-industrial complex.
That's a good understatement. So this is now, when I start researching this, we're in 92, 93, 94, as I'm starting to get into it. And so I'm a psychiatrist, so I was treating people with multiple personality. And that's the time frame where False Memory Syndrome Foundation was formed, which was a group that was basically spearheading lawsuits against therapists who were treating multiple personality. And
who was bringing the lawsuits against legitimate therapists who were trying to treat MPD, DID cases? Who were these people? Was this an organized effort? Could you tell?
Oh, yeah. No, it's absolutely organized, no question. And there's no doubt about that. It's not any kind of, leap of imagination. It's very clearly publicly documented. But so individual patients basically would sue their therapists for implanting false memories.
Uh-huh.
And then there's, lawyers around the country would take those cases. And it's sort of like, one decade there's asbestos lawsuits, and then next there's like babies damaged from birth. And these lawsuits kind of come and go. There's a wave, and then they go on to the next thing. So there was a whole series of these lawsuits in the first half of the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But behind the scenes, all the experts testifying in these cases belong to this organization, the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, and they wrote in journals and were very public and clear that they thought multiple personality was ridiculous and it was all created by the therapist.
I remember this. This was in the news, False Memory Syndrome Foundation, and they tried to mock the whole thing.
Oh, absolutely. And it was a big deal for me personally because that's my area of specialty, and the field was getting pretty stressed out with all these lawsuits and all this ridicule and so on. And so on the board, and the organization was run by a couple of people, but they had this professional advisory board. So on the board, this I all discovered in the course of investigating all this, on the board were the two guys who died in the late 90s, but Martin Orn, a psychiatrist, and Louis Jolyon West, usually could just be known as Jolly West. And so they were on the board of this foundation, and the foundation was basically saying, all these cases of multiple personality are bogus. They're just created by the therapist. It's just suggestion and therapy. And all the memories they're describing are false memories that were just suggested and implanted by the therapist. And then a subgroup within this organization was fathers who had been accused of incest, and so they were using these experts in this false memory defense.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another group in there that was kind of memory researchers that had their theories of how memory works didn't fit with people repressing trauma for a long time. And then there's a group of kind of biological psychiatrists who didn't want abuse to have anything to do with anything in psychiatry. So there's all these kind of constituencies. But the problem... So there's several dimensions of the problem. One is just that his dad needed a defense against the incest accusations. And then actually I actually ended up being an expert witness against therapists where I thought that they were committing malpractice and it was horrible practice. So it wasn't, just the therapists were all getting attacked for no reason. But in the middle of all this complicated mess, we have patients, kind of like the ones that I was sharing from, who were describing being victims of CIA military mind control experimentation as kids and having multiple personality created on purpose by these doctors. And so lo and behold, two of the doctors who are on the professional advisory board of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, which is Martin Orn and Jolly West, are their MKUltra contractors cleared to top secret, but they also contracted with many other branches of the military. So they, and then their projects, when you read the project documents, are clearly about the Manchurian Candidate programs. So they clearly were contractors directly involved in the Manchurian Candidate programs. And they went to conferences with, co-authored with, published with, other guys who were directly involved in CIA military contracting. So I built up this whole web of interconnections. Now, this is all totally documented, not just a theory at all.
I understand.
And so one of the functions of this whole false memory syndrome foundation and all these claims it's all false memories was to cover up Manchurian Candidate programs and have a way to discredit anybody who comes into civilian therapy, starts to remember being worked on by military or intelligence agency. So that's kind of the background context of all of this.
Yes, yes. One other thing, the idea that the False Memory Syndrome Foundation is an obvious and visible head of the beast doesn't exclude the fact that they have, with this kind of group, penetrated many areas of our culture, our society, including your profession. There are people in your profession who are experts in the field of dealing with DID, MPD, who are part of that whole False Memory Syndrome Foundation group, if you will. I tend to call it a cult. I think there are other things involved having to do with pedophilia, sacrifice, and lots of other things. I guess the bottom line is mind control in this society, in this day and age, is not a guessing game. It is an abject science.
Right. So when you go back to I'm not sure about who you're thinking of who's an expert in DID, other than Martin Orr and Jolly West.
No, I'm talking about no one with any particular name, but they, I am told, do place people in positions of authority as alleged experts in helping people with DID and MPD, when in fact they're there to further obfuscate the problem on a larger scale. In other words, there's a penetration. It's not just part of the foundation. So they play many tricks and wear many hats.
Well, if there's anybody like that operating, I'd like to identify them and ferret them out, that's for sure.
Yeah, I would too.
But I lost my train of thought there.
It's all right. You're talking about MKUltra and the idea that this is being defended professionally and in an public relations sense.
When you're talking about how widespread it is and how it's not casual at all, so the origins of it probably go back like thousands of years or something, but the modern origin is this guy named G.H. Estabrooks, who I have all these documents that I got from Colgate University, where he spent his career basically, which is in upstate New York, and his archives are there. And this includes correspondence back and forth between him and J. Edgar Hoover spanning several decades.
Yeah.
And publications by him as early as the 1943. And then up until 1971, describing being a contractor, creating this artificial multiple personality for the military during the Second World War.
Now, you notice that Dr. Ross is saying a contractor. A contractor is a professional who does a job. He's not somebody who experiments and plays with theories, all right? In other words, this is a deployed science. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So these guys, he describes in great detail in these publications, and I've got him extensive documentation of him corresponding with J. Edgar Hoover, having top-ranking FBI people out to his conferences.
Wow.
Giving talks on various military bases on the uses of hypnosis and warfare, creation of the super spy. And he describes in a lot of detail basically creating the Manchurian Candidate, which is the artificial multiple personality, having hypnotic control, having programmed codes to activate the programmed alter personality, insert the mission parameters, and the person having amnesia for the whole thing. So he describes that in great detail, and he says it was operational, and I have him...
and this goes back to the how? What is the date of this again?
Second World War. 40s and 50s.
Okay.
Operational during the Second World War.
Wow.
So I have his contract with the War Department. And I
Wow. And as you said, and this is a key part of it, total victim amnesia. The multiple, the DID victim doesn't know it, never knows it, no way they can know it. This is something that's been around 60 years now that they've been doing this, or more.
Right. And in the Bluebird and Artichoke were two mind control programs in the early 50s.
Uh-huh, I've read about them. Yeah.
It started with Bluebird, rolled over into Artichoke. And in those documents, it describes very clearly simulation experiments using actually secretaries and civilians who were just handy, and programming people to either go into a room and retrieve documents off of a person, or pull the trigger on a gun that they thought was loaded to kill somebody else in an experiment and have no memory for it. So these things are described very clearly in the experimental level, and then Estabrooks describes them very clearly being operational. So this is a very well-documented thing. It's not just a theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Now, you said something about the victim. We'll call him a victim. The victim of DID-MPD programming has amnesia. They don't remember. Are there any signs, such as lost time, which are absolute benchmark, which have to be met for the person to be declared either a victim or a non-victim? In other words, if someone is...
Yes and no.
Okay, you got the question.
Yeah.
Is there always missing time in the case of a multiple or DID who has been programmed? Is there always missing time? Are there markers?
Well, here's why it's yes and no. So if they, and it's complicated, and there's always many layers to all these things.
And exceptions,
so it's not usually
yes.
just one straightforward answer. But
of course, yeah.
The basic idea is, I think it's not to get the person to do something they wouldn't ordinarily do.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can get military people to go in and spy or infiltrate or kill people or take out targets or...
Just under orders, yeah.
Yeah, just normally. So it's not that these mentoring candidate people do stuff that nobody else would ordinarily do, or that somebody else in the military or the intelligence community couldn't do. I think it's all about the amnesia. That's my view of it. And that the purpose of the amnesia is really to make them resistant to interrogation. So if they're captured and they're interrogated, they genuinely have no memory of the operation.
Captured by the military, Colin, or also captured by police authorities or anyone else. They've got no memory, I understand.
Right, and so I think the whole thing about will somebody do something they wouldn't ordinarily do if they're subjected to all this kind of programming, it's kind of part of the story, but I think it's kind of a side question. And then in academia, what you see is all kinds of debates, and you know, people will have huge attitudes and emotions about, oh, it's not possible to make somebody do something they wouldn't ordinarily do. I think it's kind of a distraction and a sideshow. But really, the core of it is the amnesia and the security that comes from the amnesia. And in the Bluebird and Artichoke document, it describes programs to try and detect Manchurian candidates being run against the CIA by foreign intelligence agencies.
Mm-hmm.
So they have methodology already in place to do that.
Right. Does amnesia constitute lost time? Does amnesia necessarily equate to someone missing 4 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours a day? Or can it be something that is just that quick?
All different combinations are possible. So the reason why I was kind of humming and hawing a bit there before is the classical picture is it's 10 o'clock in the morning and you're at home. All of a sudden it's 7 p.m. You're downtown. You're some people.
Sure.
You have no idea how you got there.
Got it.
And you know, it's just lights off and then lights back on.
And yeah.
civilian patients describe that. That's a hallmark question that you ask for.
Mm-hmm.
But you can have, like, if you were a sleeper mentoring candidate, for instance, your whole system could be kind of locked down until a handler activates you. And so then you would have this internal system created, but it would never emerge spontaneously. And therefore, you wouldn't experience missing time for prolonged periods of time. Another variation, and this is all just things that we see clinically with civilian patients all the time, is some people will have a period of missing time, and they just kind of shrug it off and don't even quite think anything about it. And sometimes people think that's just the way everybody is. So they either notice it and they're kind of not disturbed by it and don't think it's a very big deal, or they just shrug it off. Or there's another thing called amnesia for amnesia, which is you can just fudge out the fact that you're missing a period of time.
Sure.
So all these, you know, combinations are possible.
And if that were the instruction of a handler, that would be the end of it.
Right.
You could be given that instruction in person. You could be given that instruction over the telephone. From what I understand, a phone call and a keyword will put someone who is a candidate in a trance, hypnotic state, or in a mode to be programmed. However, a keyword.
Right. And the Bluebird Artichoke early 1950 documents, they describe a whole series of different codes and ways of activating the program personality,
mm-hmm.
which include hand signals, tones over the phone, verbal signals. In the movie, The Manchurian Candidate, the original movie, it's a playing card. So you can really pair any stimulus you want. So these things that seem fictional that you just see in The Manchurian Candidate movie, actually they're all in the CIA documents from the 50s.
That's extraordinary. All right, we'll take a break here for a couple of minutes. We're talking to Dr. Colin Ross, MD, psychiatrist, about an area of our society and our time that few understand. And we're very grateful and indebted to him for being here tonight to do this. We'll be right back. MD is our guest, talking about DID, or MPD as it used to be known, and mind control. We've talked about military CIA mind control, which Dr. Ross knows more about than probably anybody because of his research. You've heard him talk about that. He went and got the documents. World War II, this was a deployable and deployed way of running people and controlling them and using them as weapons and tools. Now, there are also people who have incestuous families. There is what I refer to loosely as the cult. It is a national organization, as it were, unofficial, of pedophiles who engage in all kinds of satanic practices with young people, male and female, which it is said, Dr. Ross, you know more than I, every time a young boy or girl is raped as a 4, 5, or 6-year-old, a different personality can be formed, and this is how, allegedly, the whole thing is set up. These are non-military constructs, but they suffer from family abuse or the cult. There are a lot of these out there. I assume you see them in your practice all the time.
Yeah, I've done quite a lot of research. So I was taught which a lot of psychiatrists still believe because they don't know the literature and basically have bad attitudes. But I was taught that multiple personality is extremely rare. But I and others have done research. I think we're up at about like 8 or 9 different countries, and there's 10 or 12 different studies looking at psychiatric inpatients, just general adult inpatients, not people with a dissociative diagnosis.
Uh-huh.
And when you add up all these studies in all these different countries, which is close to 2,000 people screened, it's about 3.4% of psychiatric inpatients have multiple personality that you can, or dissociative identity disorder that you can identify in a research interview. They've never been told they have it. They've never been treated for it. They don't think that they have it. But you can pick it up, you know, just with a standardized research interview. And that's, you know, 1 out of 30 inpatients. And there's similar studies.
Yeah. Now, these people, when you bring this data to them, and I don't know how you would broach the subject, but as a professional, you have your ways. I would assume that there's...
published in professional journals.
Yeah. I would assume that the patient would be in abject denial that they might be suffering from DID and have multiples.
Right. Usually. Sometimes they know they have, quotes, other people inside, but they don't know what the term for that is.
Yeah, and it's not bipolar. We got to get that cleared up. No, bipolar is being thrown around all over the place. This is
way overdiagnosed these days.
Yeah, this is something entirely different we're talking about.
Right. There can be kind of a confusing overlap between the two.
I'm sure.
Yeah, they're different things.
The idea.
A small number of people also might have both at the same time, but not very many.
Okay, good point. We talked about missing time. Not there are variants of that, yes and no. It's kind of a 6 of 1, half a dozen of another potential within each person, I guess. What about things like bruises that might show up on someone where they have rather severe bruise where they have no idea where they got the bruise? None.
That's
a sign?
The basic typical questions that are in these research interviews and in the literature include, do you have periods of missing time that are not just, you know, 5 seconds or 10 seconds, or you zone out while you're driving? There's a period of minutes or sometimes hours or even days where you're just totally gone, and then all of a sudden you come back, and you may come back in a different location. You don't know how you got there.
That's extreme.
Do people come up and talk to you and seem to know you and talk about things you've done, but they're strangers to you? People ever call you by a different name? Do people describe you behaving differently during periods of time you don't remember? Do you find objects present, which isn't just, oh, there's my pen that I displaced? Like a classical picture would be somebody opens their closet and there's like 3 new outfits, very different style from what they ordinarily would wear.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the bag with the credit card receipt, and they bought it yesterday at 3:30, and they were blanked out from 11 in the morning till 4 at night, at 4 p.m. So clearly, it was they themselves did it, and they don't remember. So finding things like that around, or things will go missing, like your journal goes missing, and then 2 weeks later, you find it stuffed down behind the pillow on the couch, and there's some sort of really angry handwriting in there, so a different type of handwriting from what you normally would do. Then hearing voices inside your head talking to you and talking to each other, having a serious childhood trauma history.
Say again?
Serious childhood trauma history.
Sexual trauma?
Sexual, physical, family violence.
Mm-hmm. Beatings.
Death, chaos, mm-hmm. Beatings, yeah, the whole works. Neglect. Mm-hmm. So what? The more of all of that you get, the higher and higher the likelihood that the person with dissociative identity disorder.
How quickly do these, we'll call them personalities or moods, how quickly can these moods, personalities change in someone?
It can be almost instantaneous to seconds to half a minute sort of thing.
So they can modulate into a totally different frame of mind, or they can just snap and all of a sudden become very happy, very sad, very angry.
And it can be subtle and just look like changeable moods, or mm-hmm. sometimes they'll disguise it very well, and you won't really kind of notice anything from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes it's just like abrupt explosion from black to white. But if it was so obvious most of the time, then most psychiatrists would be diagnosing it much more readily.
So it is a subtle thing, and not something that someone would necessarily present to a psychiatrist in a clinical setting until there was, I would assume, a track history of some time. It's something that people learn to keep hidden.
Right, and usually they come to the mental health system either with depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, substance abuse, eating disorder, or all of the above. And then they can be in and out of the mental health system for years, seeing typical, regular, average psychiatrists who would never diagnose the DID at all.
Mm-hmm. If someone is, again, we're not talking about military candidates here, but just the general public, abused as a child, beatings, psychological trauma, sexually abused, whatever, whether at home or another location, would they, in addition to growing up with DID and multiples, retain at some basic human level an incredible amount of anger and rage at being violated?
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Anger stuffed inside and turned on yourself in the form of attacks on the self, emotional, mental, self-talk attacks, or attacking yourself literally by cutting on yourself is very, very, very common.
Or attacking those
so
around
turning
you.
It outwards and attacking, well, one personality attacking another internally, or also, so that's, women generally turn their anger on themselves. Men are more culturally programmed to turn the anger outwards. So, but yeah, lots of anger.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of shame and lots of self-blame.
Lack of self-esteem?
Low self-esteem. Which I always say is not really low self-esteem, it's really high self-hatred, because the child blames him or herself for the abuse and the neglect, and thinks, so this is happening because I'm bad and I deserve it. And then those beliefs get reinforced so much, they're still kind of running the show 20, 30, 40 years later.
What a tragedy.
Yeah, it's a horrible, horrible mess, but the good news is, if you get into treatment, you really roll up your sleeves, you get to work, you stick with it, you have a skilled therapist, amazing recovery is realistically possible.
If a child or children, and you've probably seen these as adults, are abused by a father, a mother, an uncle, as a youngster, 4, 5, 6, it's a common age, 3, do they at some point run into communication difficulties with those parents? Do the parents not treat them normally? Do the parents, in some cases, want to disavow them? How do the parents deal with this when the parents know that terrible things have happened to those children, their own children?
Well, of course, quite frequently, the parents are the perpetrators. Most child sexual abuse is actually inside the family, or people known well to the family. The dirty old man down the street is actually a minority of the perpetrators. So often the parents are threatening the kid, telling him not to talk, and presenting, you know, the facade of the normal family to the outside world. And there's tremendous loyalty conflict in the victim survivor, because on the one hand, it's mom and dad.
Right, sure.
So you love them and you depend on them and you're loyal to them and you just have a basic blood bond with them. And on the other hand, you fear them and hate them because they're your perpetrator. That's an incredibly deep and painful conflict.
And that conflict can be passed on to others in later life?
Well, definitely. And then that's just a setup for getting into an abusive marriage as an adult. And then you go to the battered spouse shelter and then the loyalty pulls you back. You're back with your perpetrator again because that's where you feel safe. Perpetrator apologizes. Everything's great for a while. Then you get abused again. Around and around that cycle goes.
Right.
That cycle often has been set up in childhood.
I've heard that before, yeah.
So the conflict, I call that the problem of attachment to the perpetrator, is not just something that happened a long time ago. It's dominating your life in the present. As is the self-blame, that's all I'm for, that's all I deserve, it's my fault. If I go back and be a better wife, maybe he won't beat me anymore. That kind of thinking can absolutely dominate somebody's mind in their 20s, 30s, 40s. That's common.
Anger is a growing problem in this society. Growing.
It's a gigantic problem.
There used to be talk of anger management classes and all of that, but I see it, frankly, as out of control in the movies and the media and the entertainment business. Certainly, we see it all over the so-called news tabloids. We see death, dying, rage all over the world. It's an angry planet.
I agree 100%. And I think it's actually even more widespread than that, in a sense, because, like, I've published 170 papers in different journals. So I've, you know, been involved in academia a lot. And I often say that these debates that go on in academia, they're like drive-by shootings at an intellectual level. And people are just incredibly nasty, hostile, dismissive of people with different points of view. And then you see that on CNN or everywhere on TV, not in the violent programs, just people in the left wing talking to people on the right wing, and the people in the right wing talking to the people in the left wing, and campaigning for president. Everywhere in our culture, there's just this violent, hostile, angry, belittling attacks on other people. So I think it's really everywhere in our culture, not just physical violence, but verbal, emotional violence.
All right, let me go back to this FMS thing. The people behind that would obviously be perpetrators.
I think it's not. It's a hodgepodge of different people. So there's a perpetrator subgroup, but not everybody.
Right. I didn't mean to say everyone, but it's got to be the core of it, the motivation of it.
Yeah, I agree.
And have you heard of Dr. Catherine Gould?
Yeah, I'm aware of her.
Uh-huh.
I don't know her personally.
Yeah, she's working in the field and was in Southern California. One, there aren't too many, and there are very, very few on the planet, as I said, at your level at all. You are obviously one who understands the human condition like few do. And when I mentioned anger as being really an out-of-control pandemic on this planet, it doesn't just seat in those with DID or MPD. It is something that is in everybody. Not everybody, but, you know, in the pejorative sense. It is something that is an accepted way of life now, and it's reflected in the entertainment.
Oh, yeah, there's an amazing amount of violence in the entertainment industry and anger.
And it's not something that's going to just go away, because when you have young people imbued with this, they carry it for life, and they tend to teach it, they tend to act it out, and the kids pick it up, and they're imprinted, and it must seem to you like an avalanche of astounding galactic proportions.
Good description of it. So I grew up in Canada, I don't even know what the count would be, but I shot up in the Canadian Arctic where I lived for a number of years back in the 70s. There's a type of grouse there.
Yes.
Which is called a ptarmigan that turns white in the winter.
I know, it starts with a P.
Yeah, I know. That's a stupid joke I heard the other day. Why can't you hear a pterodactyl going to the bathroom? Because the P is silent.
Silent. Yes, I guess. Yeah. Very good.
Yeah. That's the mature side of me. So I shot literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of ptarmigan when I was up there. So, you know, I owned guns. I hunted. I ate everything that I shot. So I wasn't an anti-gun person at all. But I grew up in Canada where there's just not all these automatic weapons and handguns everywhere. So, you know, I come from a culture where it's not the norm to have this amazing number of guns. But clearly it is the norm in the United States. And the way I see it is, if you have this much anger and this many guns, then all these mass shootings are just inevitable collateral damage. And you're not going to solve it just by regulating guns, or I don't think you're going to solve anything by increasing mental health funding. But a huge part of the problem is all this anger we have in our culture. And so if you have this combination of all this anger and all these guns, it's just like if you have X number of people smoking cigarettes, you're going to have a certain amount of...
It's statistically expected. It has to happen, of course. The idea of anger in an adult, male or female, with MPD, DID, even a young adult, doesn't matter, a teenager, is that the anger, it would seem to me, would express itself in many, many different ways, correct? It commonly
expresses itself in attacks on the self.
That's what you said.
Yeah. But there's tons of anger in there, yeah.
How does one begin to deal with anger and quench it, misdirect it, redirect it, reconfigure it, when one denies that there is an anger problem? And, you know, most people, if you ask them, are you an angry person, they'll say, nope, not a chance.
Right.
So how do they, what happens? What do these people
Well, the
have
people
to,
I work with, frankly, they've walked their path in life for quite a while, and they've decided to come to treatment. Because, you know, automatically, I don't see people who don't come for treatment. So the people I work with have figured out something's terribly wrong. They feel horrible. They're depressed. They're suicidal. Their life is off track. And they need to do something about it. They may not understand all the ins and outs of it, but it's crystal clear that there's a major, big problem. And they're motivated. They have a good work ethic. So that's totally different from somebody who's just, you know, sitting out in the world in denial, beating mm-hmm. their wife all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But, and, you know, the therapy takes years, so I'm just going to boil it down to quick outline. So first of all, you have to be motivated to do the work. And if you're like the alcoholic who thinks he doesn't have a problem, you're never going to get started. So you got to admit you have a problem, admit your life is kind of out of control, much like alcoholism treatment. Then you got to make a serious commitment to getting to work on it. And then that's where it starts. So the first thing, like I'll do as a therapist, is I'll talk about anger. And it's called normalizing it, is the term in the field. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'll tell a story about, okay, so there's a mother bear walking through the woods with a baby bear, and happens to be the first day of hunting season. Hunter comes up, and he's pointing a rifle at the baby bear. And the mother bear goes, well, I have to look at both sides here. It is legal hunting season. He does have a license, so maybe he has the right to shoot baby bear. So if she's doing all that, baby bear's already dead. But if she flies into a rage and attacks the hunter and he runs away, then baby bear is safe. So that's kind of a cutesy story. But the purpose of the story is to get the person to identify with the righteous anger of the mother bear. Then I also will say, okay, so if the mother bear didn't get angry, there'd be something very wrong. And that anger has a function and a purpose. It's normal. It's good. It's healthy. And we want her to get angry.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's why we have adrenaline, and that's why we have a part of our brain that handles anger. It's built in, you know, all different mammals. The reason I'm doing this is because the person feels that their anger is toxic, evil, horrible, and they're a bad person for being angry, and anger should never be acknowledged or expressed. The reason they think that is because the anger they've been exposed to growing up is so violent and toxic
mm-hmm.
that they've been directly instructed to stuff their own anger and not say it deep and be obedient. And they've seen what happens when you let anger out, so therefore they don't. So I get them to rethink. It's like changing their model of anger.
Mm-hmm.
And so then anger is not something that's horrible or evil. It's actually a source of great energy and motivation. And if you can channel it into assertiveness, motivation, energy,
mm-hmm.
sticking to it,
mm-hmm.
now you're going somewhere. And then it's a whole laborious process of you practicing and learning how to channel it and use it in a healthy fashion.
That's a tough row to hoe. The other thing that young people do all the time, especially young people, is project onto others their own behaviors.
Young people, this is the basis of U.S. foreign policy.
Oh, yeah. How true. How incredibly true.
We demonize the enemy to a ridiculous degree.
Well, we exactly project our own behaviors on the enemy, precisely.
Right.
And this is something that, again, is common with MPD DID?
I think it's just, the way I look at MPD DID is you can learn everything about human life from people with DID.
Hmm.
It's just, like, an example is it goes back to Freud, actually, the idea of identification with the aggressor.
Mm-hmm.
So you can identify with the aggressor, take on the characteristics of the aggressor.
Like the Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah, so that's kind of an interesting theory, and you can kind of see it at work, and you can see it kind of in behind the scenes there, you know, grinding away in the person's psyche and affecting their behavior. But when somebody has DID, not every person with DID, but I've had the experience repeatedly, the dad perpetrator comes out and talks to me and tells me to leave his family alone and mind my own business. And the dad who's telling me this in the daughter's body, who's now like 37 years old, I ask him what the year is. He says, well, it's 1983 or 1976 or something. I say, well, where do you live? Oh, back in Ohio. And so your daughter lives with you, and she's how old? Oh, she's 12. And then I go, and you're a male, right, sir? Your father said you're a male. Yeah, what are you, an idiot?
Huh. Wow.
So now this is identification with the aggressor, but it's not a theory. The behavior is right there in front of them. And so it's much easy, it's kind of easy to spot when it's so graphic and so right in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not kind of this hidden theory thing about what's going on in their mind. The way the inner world of multiple personality works is often the way the outside culture works.
You must be a very brave man to look at this in the office and see things and hear things that are, as they say, out of the movies.
Yeah, it's really a case of practice stranger than fiction.
Well, Colin, thank you very much for the fascinating glimpse into a part of the human mind and psyche that we just don't hear about much. I really appreciate the time. Thank you, Colin.
You're welcome. Yeah, I'd be happy to be on again sometime.
Very good, sir. Thank you.
Okay.
Good night.
Bye.
Dr. Colin A. Ross, MD, psychiatrist. And again, these are extraordinary times, and many amazing things are going on and things we just don't talk about very often. So let's look into a big area of what's happening on this planet. We'll be right back.